Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome to the Tattered Cover. And I just want to thank you all for coming tonight. And thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores. We're excited tonight to have Mary Roach here with her just out in paperback book, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. I'm sure many of us here tonight would agree that we have been educated, entertained, and somewhat surprised by what we've learned from Mary Roach's previous books, Stiff, Spook, and Bonk. It's even fun to say, Stiff, Spook, and Bonk. Mary has also written articles for Outside Magazine, National Geographic, New Scientist, Wired, and the New York Times Magazine, among many others. Will you please join me in welcoming Mary Roach?
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's great to be back here. I love Tattered Cover. Just open my beverage. I'm really excited that I'm not drinking Tang tonight. My hardback tour, the publicist decided that it would be a really great idea to serve Tang at all of the readings, and so I would gamely pour Tang, and after a while I realized my kidneys were probably starting to fluoresce. Tang is not a NASA invention. People think that NASA invented Tang. Tang is one of those... It's one of those products that got a boost from NASA but wasn't invented by them, similar to there's other products that people assume NASA invents. An example of an off-the-shelf product that NASA uses is the adult diapers that they use in the big spacesuit when they're out doing their spacewalks. That's something you can just buy at a store. I don't know what brand they're using now, but for a while I was told by the Public Affairs Office that it was an adult diaper called Rejoice, which I thought was a really lovely, optimistic name for an adult diaper. Anyway, so Packing for Mars is not a typical space book. I don't know that you could really say that there's a typical space book, but my idea of a typical space book is kind of the, you know, boldly going and boldly coming back and lots of heroics and something exploding and along the lines of Apollo 13, you know, Jim Lovell and his crew courageously fighting for their lives on the way to the moon when there's an explosion, and it's not like that. I did talk to Jim Lovell. I interviewed him not about Apollo 13, but about Gemini 7. And Gemini 7 was, to me, absolutely fascinating because this was this era. It was after Mercury. We were getting ready for the moon, the Apollo, the moon missions. And it was kind of like running through all the sort of dress rehearsals. Gemini 7 was the first time humans had been in space for 2 weeks. Up to that point, it was just a few days. And one of the things they were looking into with Gemini 7 was what happens to the human body when you don't shower or bathe for 2 weeks and you're wearing a spacesuit 24 hours a day? Is it just too disgusting? Is it too much to ask a human being? Can you sit, you know, can you be in this tiny space with another person and, you know, like pooping in a bag? I mean, how is it just too much to ask of a human being? I call this chapter, Houston, we have a fungus. NASA has on their website, if you can find them, the mission transcripts for every mission, and it's this amazing resource. They're like 400 to 1,000 pages long. Happily, they are searchable by keyword. So you can plug in turd or whatever you want to plug in. In this Gemini 7 transcript, there's this wonderful moment where the flight surgeon comes on the microphone, the radio, and he's talking to Frank Borman, who's the commander. It's a two-man mission. And remember, this is all a lot of interest in what happens to your skin. And he goes, Gemini 7, this is Flight Surgeon. Have you had any dandruff problem up there, Frank? I mean, just to me, to see the word dandruff in a NASA transcript was just kind of an amazing thing. And later on, there was the word lotion, which just, you know, two men, grown men, orbiting the Earth, discussing skincare. It was kind of amazing. And you had to feel bad for them because it's zero gravity. This is the other thing to keep in mind, zero gravity. And one thing that's good about zero gravity, if you're in a very small space, you have the headspace. You can float up to the ceiling. So that made their lives easier. What didn't make their lives easier is that nothing falls to the ground, including dandruff. And I asked Jim Lovell about this. I said, I think my exact words were, was it just like a snow globe in there? And he said, Mary, you're investigating a rather unusual aspect of space flight. Anyway, the book is it's about the astronaut life. It's about life in space and all those very surreal challenges. But it's also about space on Earth, because everything that happens, everything that gets done up there gets rehearsed and simulated down here on Earth. And because it's so just everything, nothing works up there. No appliance, no piece of equipment is going to work up there. The human body doesn't work the same up there. I mean, take like the human bladder. Okay, this is an organ that depends on these stretch receptors. The fluid fills up at a certain point, begins to stretch, it accumulates, and it stretches the bladder, and the stretch receptors tell the brain, time to go to the bathroom. Okay, well, in zero gravity, the liquid doesn't build up on the bottom of the bladder. It kind of clings to the whole organ through surface tension, so you don't get that signal. So what happened sometimes was that astronauts would not know they had to go to the bathroom until it was too late. There was so much fluid that it was pressing the urethra shut. So you have sort of an embarrassing telephone consult to the flight surgeon, and they get out the self-catheter kit, and it was kind of a... So anyway, these astronauts would have to... these are the most high-achieving people you could imagine, and they're all sort of sent back to preschool. You've got to learn how to go to the bathroom. You've got to learn how to eat. You've got to learn how to move across the room. So it really was this kind of wonderful juxtaposition of smarts and just real learning, going back and learning the basics. Anyway, I wanted to give you an example of the extent to which we all take gravity for granted and the problems that it causes when you're dealing with a world that has no gravity. The Earth toilet. People kind of think of that's a water-based mechanism. You flush and the water, flushes it away. But in fact, gravity is involved in a very, very key way. You have this mass that is growing, this being extruded, and the more mass you have, the more gravitational pull. And at a certain point, the material, to use a euphemism that the waste management people use, breaks away because it's got a certain amount of weight. And it falls into the toilet, and it goes off on its own, and everything's well and good. But in space, you don't have gravity. So you just, the stuff kind of just hovers. And that's, you have the toilet. You have to redesign the toilet. It's now got to provide the holy grail of the NASA Waste Management Department, good separation. And that is done by airflow. So you have this kind of the toilet, the toilet's like the size of a washing machine. And this airflow, you're basically sitting on a shop vac. You've got this airflow that is by surface tension, friction, pulling the stuff away. And that works. But okay, how much airflow? If you have too much airflow, it's going to be uncomfortable. You could risk sort of, creating hemorrhoids. Too much suction isn't good. So they've got to test that thing. Well, how do you test a zero-gravity toilet? You've got to put it in a zero-gravity environment, and the only way to do that is to, haul the entire thing. And it's a big thing. Over to Ellington Field, where they do these flights. They're called parabolic flights, where the plane kind of goes like this over and over about 35 times. And as it goes over and down, you have 22 seconds of weightlessness. So, okay, that's 22 seconds. So imagine you're trying to test a toilet. That's a feat. You got to time that right, because if it were me, my colon would be going Sorry, boss, 10 a.m., absolute latest I can do. So you've got, I didn't find a guy who had been a tester, but I found somebody who had been on one of those zero gravity flights when they were testing one of the, I don't know if it was the space station, the ISS or the shuttle, but anyway, he was on there and he said he was a food guy. He was testing food systems. He had like 32 different meals. He was making sure that they would work in zero gravity. And he said, I could see they had a curtain there around it, but you could see under the curtain, and you could see, you know, when we went into the dive, you'd see like the, everything begin to lift off the bottom of the plane, and you'd hear them going like, go, 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 go. And the guy failed. Which explains why NASA Ames has in its employ an engineer whose job is to make a very high fidelity fecal simulant, which means nobody has to go up and, you know, perform on demand. So you just don't, you can't imagine the level, the intricacy and the levels of testing and problem solving that go into almost every piece of a space flight. It isn't just equipment, and it isn't the human body being a rather major piece of equipment. The human mind, the human psyche is a pretty tough. It's a piece of equipment that's very variable, that lots of things can go wrong with, especially when you put people in a small space for months and months at a time without the ability to leave or slam the door or go for a drive or take a bubble bath or have a drink or go shopping or do any of those things that people do when they're under stress. And there's a lot of stress in space. There's a lot of sleep deprivation, and you're stuck. You're just soaking in it. You can't get away from the people that are bugging you, that are driving you crazy. And these people, you might just love them to death when you start out with them, but after about 6 weeks, they're just really bugging you. So what happens if you talk to space psychologists, and they study this in simulations as well. Right now in Moscow, there's something called Mars 500, which is a series of boxes that represent space modules, and then one of them is Mars, and these people are locked in there for 500 days, being observed by psychologists and various people to see, you know, what can human beings deal with a 2 to 3 year mission to Mars psychologically? Can you cope with that? The thing that tends to happen, you get frustrated, and the frustration kind of metastasizes to anger. Now, anger wants an outlet. You got to, at some point, it's just going to come out. And you can deal with that in three. There's three things you can do with your anger in space. The first is you could take it out on your crewmates. Really, really bad idea, because it just makes it worse. You don't resolve. I mean, you depend on these people for your survival. So they tend to not explode at each other. The other thing is that happens is called displacement, and that's where you take it out on mission control. And or somebody else on the outside. If you look at Gemini 7 in the transcript, you can see this moment where Jim Lovell is at his wit's end, and what he does, he starts griping and complaining to the nutritionist. There's this moment where he gets on the microphone with the nutritionist, this guy, Dr. Chance, this poor guy. There's like five different occasions when he just lets Dr. Chance have it. And the food, by the way, really sucked. It was really bad. There's this point where he goes, memo to Dr. Chance. Chicken a la King, serial number 6247. The neck is completely sealed shut. I cannot squeeze this out. And then like a minute and a half later, further memo to Dr. Chance, chicken a la King, all over window at this time. $300 a meal, I think you can do better. Just like, it's really reaming him. And the third and probably most common thing to do with your anger, particularly on a long mission, like the ISS missions or Mir, those were 6 months to a year or more. And you turn the anger, you kind of absorb it, you turn it inward, and then you get depression. And depression has been a serious concern for, you know, some of the astronauts on Mir were very, very depressed. You didn't really hear a lot about it in the general press. But I talked to, when I was in Star City in Moscow, where the cosmonauts train. There were a couple of them that were very, very open with what it was like to be up there. Alexander Levakin was one of them, and he was up there for 6 months with this other guy. And I asked him, "What was that like? I mean, obviously, you two must have driven each other crazy at a certain point. And did you get depressed?" He said, "Mary, I was so depressed at times, I wanted to hang myself." but it's weightlessness. And you can't. Alexander Levakin was just one of the most, I was going to say down to earth, which is probably not a good description for an astronaut, but he was just the kind of person you could ask him anything. You could ask him about death or sex or anything at all, and he was just wonderfully forthcoming. I asked him about, you know, just two guys in a small space for 6 months. I said, well, how do you handle, you know, you were young guys, young, healthy men, straight men, and did you, how'd you deal with your libido? What did you do about that? And he goes, Mary, people ask me this all the time. They're saying, Sasha, that was his nickname, Sasha. They say to me, Sasha, how are you making sex in space? And he goes, of course, by hand. You know, it's like, it's duh. But if you, you know, you ask NASA about this, they're like, well, we don't feel that this is anything that was really an important issue. And our astronauts are doing really important things and they don't have time. This is really a trivialization of that. It's like, all right, screw you. I'll go to Star City. So anyway, and I wanted to show you. This is I have in this envelope here. This is actual, genuine, simulated moon soil. This is JSC 1A. JSC standing for Johnson Space Center 1A Lunar Regolith Simulant, and this is moon dust. And there is a lot of this on the moon, and it was a huge problem during Apollo. You probably didn't really hear much about it. And I'm going to be giving away, anybody buys two books gets a free limited edition packet of genuine simulated moon dust. But this stuff, there's this whole sort of small, like this whole market grew up when we thought we were going back to the moon. There was it's been scrapped now because of the change in administration and the budget problems. But they were going to build a base on the moon, and there was going to be a, you know, year-round presence on the moon. And one of the biggest problems during the Apollo era had been moon dust, because this stuff, it's very sharp. There's no atmosphere on the moon. There's no, you know, wind to kind of, you know, smooth the edges. There's no water to, so it's really sharp. It used to blow onto face plates. The Hasselblad lenses were all scratched up. It would get inside the joints of the equipment. And because there's no, the moon doesn't have the same electromagnetic field that's going to deflect solar particles. These particles, these charged particles, would bombard the surface of the moon, and so this stuff just clings like dryer socks. I mean, just these guys, you know, and they come out in the white, the beautiful, pristine, white, puffy suit, and within 5 minutes, they look like coal miners. I mean, they're just, it clings. And the inside, Apollo 12, it was so filthy inside that the three guys, this was something Jim Lovell told me, just took off their everything and flew home naked. They were just like so filthy. And these are the photographs you really want to see that are not on the NASA website. So I want to read a section from the book that is just sort of a fun section. And I'm sure it relates to something I was talking about, but I don't really remember. It's Apollo 16, and it's John Young and Charles Duke, who've been tooling around on the surface of the moon and, you know, collecting rocks, doing their thing, and now they're back inside the module, the safety of the module, and they're doing a debriefing with Mission Control. During a radio debriefing with Mission Control, out of the blue, Young declares, I don't need those. Young declares, I got the farts again. I got them again, Charlie. I don't know what the hell gives them to me. I think it's acid in the stomach. Following Apollo 15, in which low potassium levels were blamed for the heart arrhythmias of the crew, NASA had put potassium-laced orange, grapefruit, and other citrus drinks, Tang, on the menu. Young kept going. It is all there in the mission transcript. I mean, I haven't eaten this much citrus fruit in 20 years. And I'll tell you one thing, in another 12 fucking days, I ain't eating any more. And if they offer to serve me potassium with my breakfast, I'm going to throw up. I like an occasional orange. I really do. But I'll be damned if I'm going to be buried in oranges. Moments later, Mission Control comes on the line and provides Young with yet more fodder for indigestion. Orion, this is Houston. Yes, sir. Okay, you have a hot mic. Oh, how long have we had that? That's been on through the debriefing. The day after Young's comments hit the press, the governor of Florida issued a statement in defense of his state's key crop, which Charlie Duke paraphrases in his memoir. It is not our orange juice that is causing the trouble. It is an artificial substitute that does not come from Florida. In fact, it was the potassium, not the orange juice. The, quote, coefficient of flatulence, unquote, for orange juice, to use the terminology of USDA flatus researcher Edwin Murphy, on a panelist at the 1964 Conference on Nutrition in Space and Related Waste Problems, is low. Murphy reported on research that he had done using, quote, an experimental bean meal fed to volunteers who had been rigged via a rectal catheter to outgas into a measurement device. He was interested in individual differences, not just in the overall volume of flatus, but the differing percentages of constituent gases. Owing to differences in intestinal bacteria, half the population produces no methane. This makes them attractive as astronauts. Not because methane stinks, it is odorless, but because it is highly flammable. Murphy had a unique suggestion for the NASA Astronaut Selection Committee. Quote, the astronaut may be selected from that part of our population producing little or no methane or hydrogen. Hydrogen is also explosive. And a very low level of hydrogen sulfide and other malodorous trace flatus constituents not yet identified. In other words, he was actually suggesting that NASA, as part of the criteria for becoming an astronaut, choose somebody whose farts will not stink. It's a concern. The Chinese space agency apparently won't take someone with bad breath. This is something I saw reported. I mean, not a direct interview, but it was reported in the press. It's a bad breath because it suggests dental problems, but because it would stink, because it was unpleasant for the other astronauts. This is not what they did. They did the more sensible thing, and that was to avoid in the menu planning the high coefficient of flatus foods up through Apollo. Beans, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, and broccoli were blacklisted. Beans were not used until the shuttle era. And there were those who welcomed their arrival, not just because they're tasty. The zero-gravity fart has been a popular orbital pursuit, particularly on all male flights. One hears tell of astronauts using intestinal gas like rocket propellant to, quote, launch themselves across the mid-deck, as astronaut Roger Crouch put it. He had heard the claims and was dubious. Quote, the mass and velocity of the expelled gas, he told me in an email that has forever after endeared him to me, is very small compared to the mass of the human body. Thus, it is unlikely that it could accelerate a 180-pound astronaut. Crouch pointed out that an exhaled breath does not propel an astronaut in any direction, and the lungs hold about 6 liters of air versus the fart, which, as we learned from Dr. Murphy, holds at most 3 soda cans worth. Or the average person's anyway. And then we have another quote from Crouch. I just love this guy. He's retired. He's not an active astronaut. That's why he can say these things. My genes have blessed me with an extraordinary ability to expel some of the byproducts of digestion, wrote Crouch. So given that, I thought that it should be tested. In what I thought was a real voluminous and rapidly expelled purge, I failed to move noticeably. Crouch surmised that his experiment may have been compromised by the, quote, action-reaction of gas passing through the pants. Disappointingly, both his flights were mixed gender, so Crouch was disinclined to, quote, strip down naked and try it again. He was heading to Cape Canaveral and promised to ask around for some other astronauts' input, but so far no one is, as they say, spilling the beans. So I think that I'll stop there and take questions, because people usually have really fun questions on this topic. Yeah.
I have not read that book, but in the middle of the phone, so I'm trying mm-hmm. to put the two together.
Yes. There is some overlap.
Has there ever been sex in space?
I'm glad you asked. The question was, has there ever been sex in space? I spent a considerable amount of time devoting myself to this answer to this question. There are two missions where there is speculation. One of them, there was a couple. Now, NASA does not send married couples, not because they're prudish per se, but because if anything happened and there was an explosion, the whole family would be gone. So, and also they're worried that there'd be favoritism, that like if one was the commander of the mission, that the spouse would get preferential treatment. So they avoid sending couples. But one couple did get married before they went up on a shuttle mission. And they're not saying. I asked so many people, and nobody could tell me. The other couple. There's a couple in on a long Mir mission. Valery Polyakov and Elena Kondakova, who's quite a Tootsie, and they were. There was a lot of flirting that went on. But as Lavakin, the guy who gave me all my wonderful quotes, he said, "You know, we were asking him constantly, did you have sex in space?" He said, "Don't ask me this question." Now, what does that mean? Don't ask me this question. Does that mean yes, I did, or no, I didn't? I don't know. He pointed out that she's married to another cosmonaut, so that would be troublesome. So. Those are the two missions that people speculate about, and I personally don't. I wouldn't be surprised if nobody had, because if you know astronaut, if you know it goes into getting a mission, getting an assignment to fly, if you're an astronaut, you really don't want to jeopardize your odds, because someone would tell somebody, and then that'd be the end of your career. And I was trying to explain this to my agent, Jay, and I was saying, you know, there's the dedication of the career, the knowledge that you wouldn't fly again, you know, somebody's going to tell. It's really, you know, think of what you'd lose. And he goes, I don't know, it might be worth it. So, but I did get some astronauts to speculate on what it would be like, so that's in the book.
Like the 350-mile club?
That'd be the 250-mile high club, yeah. Yeah, yeah. They call it the Three Dolphin Club, and it's explained in the book. I'm not even going to go into it. But there's a whole chapter. There's a whole chapter on it. Anyway, so, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Has there ever been a time in your books or with research, as you say, where, because you do a great job of researching,
oh, thanks.
You're interviewing someone and you're just like, whoa, I was not ready for that. When you get off the telephone or you're finished interviewing.
The question is, has there been a time where I've been interviewing somebody and I've said, whoa, I'm not ready for that?
Yeah.
I think it's more the other way around. that I'll ask the question and they'll, let me get back to you on that. There was a moment in this book where I sat down. I was up on Devon Island, where they do, up in the Arctic, where they do kind of simulated excursions. They were doing some rehearsals of a Moon 2 rover expedition and trying to work out how that would work. And I was talking to this guy, John Clark, and I didn't realize at the time his wife was Laurel Clark, who was killed in the Columbia explosion, the shuttle. And as I realized that when I was talking to him, I didn't really know. I was curious because he'd been involved in the autopsy reports of the crew, and I was like, how was that? I wanted to say, how were you able to cope with that? It was your wife, and you were involved, because he's as a flight surgeon, but I couldn't take him through that again, so I didn't really know what to do. That's a moment where I was kind of sort of. Caught off guard and didn't really know how to respond. But other than that, I can't really. You mean more like somebody said something shocking, or
some of the stuff that you've researched and has been
No, what happens is once you step into the world, if you step into the world, Bonk was people who study arousal and orgasm and sexual physiology and the biomechanics of sex. But once you've stepped into that world, it kind of becomes your normal world too. And after a few weeks, really, nothing phases you. And yeah, I became this person who would go around like penis, vagina, clitoris, masturbation, and like the words just lost their charge and anything. Nobody could really say anything that would shock me. Or yeah, it becomes normal really quickly. And I don't think I'm special. I think that's just your reality shifts abruptly. Yeah, but that's a great question though. Other questions? Yes.
Two questions. I find this hard to believe, but with all your footnotes and everything, was there any really cool piece of information that you just had to leave out for whatever reason in any of your books?
A cool piece of information that I had to leave out. There was a footnote, and it wasn't really cool. It was a dark footnote, and it's in the advanced reading copy. Somebody brought it up in Boulder at the bookstore last night. They said, so there's this footnote that talks about how vacuum chambers have been occasionally used for murder and suicide. And I was like, oh, yeah. That's just, it was just a topic that it was a bit of a downer because it had to do with the early studies that the Lovelace Foundation did in what happens when you put somebody in the vacuum of space. And, you know, does the body explode? Do they just wait? They were trying to answer that question, and they used anesthetized animals. And so it was just something where I took it out. So I don't usually take out, if it's really good stuff, it's in there. I've never left out anything good. For me, it's more of a challenge to find enough of the stuff I really like to fill a book with it. So I'm never leaving any of the fun stuff out. The footnotes, tend to be stuff that doesn't really fit the narrative, but I can't bear to leave it out. And it's been interesting with the e-reader, though, because all the footnotes, there's no page. The page changes depending on the type size, so it's very difficult to get the footnotes to work. They kind of put them at the end, so people have to go and then come back. So I hope that's not too difficult for people. Anyway.
What's your next book?
The next book is still under wraps for now. I'm working on it. I'm writing it. I've done a lot of the research, and I'm you'll see. I'll be back here, I'm sure. Yeah.
I know in the Mars 500 study in Moscow.
Yeah.
One of the challenges is that everything that they're going to have is with them from day one.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's actually a mission psychologist who's done things like hide things around to be opened or found to give them a little variety.
Oh, okay.
Do you know?
I know that they do that even on a orbital mission. The question was, have I heard about that? Or
yeah. Do you have any more examples of mission psychology?
The question was, the Mars 500 simulated Mars mission, one of the things psychologists had done is to help them, not be inundated with tedium, was they would put surprises here, or like put things in places that would surprise them. I know that they'll, at one point, one of the shuttle missions, I think it was ISS, International Space Station, because those are longer missions, they surprised them with ice cream. It came on a resupply mission. Things that they weren't expecting. And that's huge, those resupply missions, when you get it used to be a bag of mail. Now they can do email, but it used to be these letters from home were hugely important and anticipated, and so any kind of surprise, it would be, because it's just there's so much monotony. There's this wonderful moment in it's called Diary of a Cosmonaut, and it's about the Salyut 1, which is the Russian, the first space station. These guys are up there 223 days, and there was a study that was supposed to be done where they were looking at how onion plants would grow in zero gravity, and the shipment on that same shipment there was these onion bulbs, and there was some bread and salt. And the astronauts opened it up, and they saw the bread and the salt and these onion shoots, and they just looked so good. They ate them, and then weeks go by, and the scientists are going, "What's going on with the onions?" And they go, "Yeah, they bloomed. They're doing really well." They went, "Really? They bloomed? Oh, that's so great!" And they got all excited. They're like, "All right, get off the phone. Get on the private line. Look, we have to tell you. Don't be angry. We ate your science." Because they just there's so little green. I mean, there's another quote. I think it might be the same mission. No, it was a different Salyut mission where they had a greenhouse experiment, and one of the cosmonauts described the little plants. They were soy plants, I think, and he said, "They are our love." Because they're living green things. And even from Antarctica, I met these guys had been down in Antarctica wintering over, and there's no green down there, and there's no babies, there's some wildlife, but not a lot. And they came back to Christchurch after being down there, and they told me that they were walking down the street, and I was like looking at the trees, and then they look across the street and they go, "Oh, a baby," and they run across the street. Then this woman turns the baby carriage and runs. So that's I don't envy those first pioneers to Mars.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming. Don't forget, if you buy two copies of the book, you get the limited edition genuine simulated lunar regolith. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.